Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCillaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever-so-slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, October 30th, 2011, and this is show number 336. For years and years, I've been trying to get in as a speaker at Macworld, and I'm thrilled to announce that this year I was actually accepted. I am so excited about this, and I'm especially excited because the paper that they chose is very, very risky. The name of my presentation is Blindfolded. Yep, I'm going to do my entire presentation blindfolded, demonstrating the voiceover accessibility features of iOS and OS X. I actually did this to kind of try and force myself to learn how to do it. Yeah, I've played around from time to time, but quickly I turn it off because it actually drives me out of my mind. I've decided to approach this, though, like learning a language. You know, you can take a class once a week to learn Spanish, or you can just live in Spain for the summer. One way seems to work slightly better, and I believe that is the immersion method. So, I have 2 months to learn to be at least moderately proficient at navigating iOS and OS X. So, I thought maybe I should keep a running diary of what I'm learning and talk a little bit about the learning process, how I'm going through it. If by some miracle I get good at this incredibly quickly, I won't be needing to do weekly updates. But so far, it looks like this might be a torturous trail, a little harder than I thought it would be. Let's start out with the iPhone. If you'd like to play along with our home game while you're listening, try this. Open Settings, go to General, and then scroll down to Accessibility. Turns out there's more than one type of accessibility. They've got the stuff for the blind, but there's also motor difficulties, there's hearing difficulties, a lot of different features. But for now, just turn on VoiceOver. Two things happen when you do this. First, the phone starts to speak to you. But also, oddly, it gives you visual clues showing you what's active on screen by drawing a box around the item. Now, this is super handy for me because it helps me figure out when I'm botching things up. I keep typing things and thinking I'm in one window when I'm really in another, and I open my eyes and the little box is around some other feature. I'm not exactly sure why it's there for the visually impaired, but it's really helpful for me. The hardest thing to get used to in VoiceOver on iOS for me is that you don't tap items to select them, you double tap. Now that makes sense because you have to touch them first with your finger to figure out what they are, so a single tap isn't really going to work. I'm getting reasonably good at remembering to double tap, but my accuracy is really, really bad. I often have to double tap like 2 to 3 times before I get it right. If I do it while I'm looking, I don't have any trouble with that, so I think I must be moving my finger around too much, I'm not really sure. So I got to keep working on that. Now I'm working really hard at learning to type, and that is a really big challenge. Again, we're still on iOS. I'm a touch typist, and I run about, 60 words per minute. Oddly, this seems to be a disadvantage, because it turns out my brain doesn't actually know where the keys are. Each finger knows where the key is that it's supposed to be pushing. So let's say on a keyboard, my right ring finger knows where the O key, is. But when I'm using my index finger on an iPhone, my brain only has a vague recollection of where that O actually is. I was shocked by this and kind of fascinated by the way the brain works, so I'm having to learn where the keys actually are, which seems really strange for a touch typist. There's also 3 ways to type in VoiceOver. When you drag your finger over a key, the nice lady says, O. Then if you hang out there for a bit, she says the military call name for it, Oscar. Kind of cool if you didn't catch it at first. Then to type the key, you can double tap. But we already discussed my reliability or lack thereof at double tapping in the same location. So here's the other way you can do it. You can hold your finger down on the O key so you don't lose your place, and then tap with any other finger on screen to select it. Now I'm still getting the hang of which fingers to use, but this works maybe closer to like 80% for me now instead of the 50% of double tapping. Oh, and here's another cool thing. So remember the nice lady tells you the key you're on. So she says O. Then a completely different lady tells you when you've actually successfully selected the key. So when you hit when you hit the space bar after spelling out a word, the second nice lady reads the word aloud to you. But for some reason, she often tells me that the word is misspelled. I'm not quite sure why that is. Maybe because it's always misspelled. But anyway, the third way you're supposed to be able to do it, and I have yet to figure out how to actually activate this, is you're supposed to be able to move around to a key and then simply lift your finger and have it kick in. I'm going to have one of my blind buddies help me out with that. Dan Eckmeyer's in the chat room right now, and I'm hoping maybe he'll tell me how to trigger that method, because I'm not super successful with the tap and tap with the other finger kind of a method. But I am only about 3 or 4 days into this. As of week one of my journey, it takes me about 12 minutes to post a one-line tweet or email, and I have to open my eyes to fix things, say, like 5 times in that 12 minutes. I'm hoping I get better accuracy than that in the next 8 weeks. Sadly, that's the good news. iOS is much more successful for me so far than OS X. I'm kind of discouraged right now about OS X, but, you know, I'm going to stick in there. They have a 23-page tutorial that lets you practice each thing you learned, which is just really, really awesome. The bad news is that there's so much to learn. They have what they call the VO keys. That's Control and Option. So when they tell you how to navigate, the instructions will say VO, right arrow. Okay, not too bad. I'm getting used to that. But I can't remember when to use the right arrow versus the down arrow, and I keep getting it wrong. Then there's selecting controls. You have to use VO, shift, and arrows. Try right now on your keyboard. Try it. Try to hold down Command, Control, and Shift at the same time with one hand. Yeah, you kind of have to mash all three buttons, your thumb, or risk dislocating your ring finger as you reach around. I also studied some videos that explain this mysterious thing they call the rotor. For the longest time, I couldn't even find the rotor. And not being able to find it, I couldn't figure out what it even was. But my blind friends were always saying, oh yeah, the rotor rocks, that really helps. Well, I finally found it, believe it or not, in a PDF document on accessibility, and then I found a video explaining it. Kind of strange that I had to watch a video to learn how to use it, since if I couldn't see, that video would have been no good to me at all, but again, very helpful for me. So here's how you do it. You hold down the VO keys, that's Control and Option, and then on the trackpad, you rotate 2 fingers to turn the rotor. I'm sorry, to turn on the rotor. Now, I still didn't know what the rotor actually was. Once it's on, you rotate 2 fingers on the trackpad without the VO keys held down, and now you get a visual indication on screen of this radio-like dial with a little dial going around. As you rotate your fingers, it'll change from links to headings to forms and other things. Okay, I still didn't know what that meant. More studying revealed that once you set the rotor to, say, headings, now when you're on a web page, you can use 2-fingered swipe on the trackpad to move down the page, jumping from heading to heading. Okay, anybody's head hurt yet? I thought it was really hard learning the lion gestures. That was like kindergarten compared to what I'm having to learn on this. I don't know. I hope I can get this going. I absolutely do not have the hang of this yet, but I guess I shouldn't be so hard on myself. Like I said, it's only been, 3 or 4 days so far. It's good to know that I have friends like Slough and Daryl and Shane and the tech doctor and Dan and, out there to help me. And they, so far, everybody's been really good. Stay tuned. Hopefully on next week's installment of Blindfolded, you'll hear me say, oh, wow, I can't believe I thought this was hard. Hopefully. I'm sure you all know Don McAllister and his fabulous training series, Screencasts Online, right? Well, if you haven't checked them out, go over to screencastsonline.com and check them out after the show. He gives one free session a month and then 2 or 3 paid-for sessions via a subscription service. Easy for me to say. Anyway, his instruction is just over-the-top fantastic. The thing that amazes me most is that even though I consider myself fairly accomplished on the Mac, I am constantly learning from Don. He sees things in the menus that just completely escape me, and I don't know how he does it. I mean, like, I remember he was doing the tutorial on Aperture, and when he was importing files, he went over to the right-hand side of the screen. And there were a whole bunch of things you could do over there. I'd never even noticed there were things you could do on the right-hand side of the screen. I mean, I know that sounds obvious, but really, it's pretty amazing the stuff he picks up on. He seems to just get every little bit of goodness out of an application. So anyway, the reason I bring this up is because recently he did several segments in a row all about Lion and the changes to some of the core apps like Safari and Preview, along with changes in the Finder like Quick Look. He looked at versioning, how autosave works, Launchpad, Mission Control, all kinds of really meaty stuff that's in the new OS. As I was watching and learning, I thought about my friends Diane and Bill, who just switched back to the Mac after about a 15-year hiatus. And I was trying to think how to get them to see Don's instructions, because I knew if they could see that, it would really help jumpstart their new adventure. I'm not sure they'd be consistent subscribers to his podcast, but I knew they'd get a lot out of this particular these segments that I was watching. Then I took a look at the next session he posted. and it was all about the Mac app he has called SCOTutor for Lion. He's packed up all of the sessions. It's like more than 2 hours of content, but he packed it all up into a video player application. So when you download it, you get all of the videos and a video player, and it's got chapter markers, so you can jump to just the exact part you want to learn or relearn, which is really important. A lot of times I remember something he taught me, and I sit there going, oh, man, I can't watch an hour to go find that one little bit. But with these chapter markers and tags and all this kind of stuff, you're going to be able to jump to just what you wanted to see. And he even has subtitles in English, Spanish, Brazilian Portuguese, and simplified Chinese, and more languages will be on the way as he does updates. This is the perfect app for my friends, and if you buy it, you'll get all this Don McAllister goodness for $4 on the Mac App Store. I put an affiliate link in the show notes so you can go check it out. If you like it, and I am 100% certain you will, because who doesn't love Don and that adorable British accent, be sure to leave Don a comment and rating. Heck, did you know it's the number one paid app in Barbados? It's gotta be good.
I can't help but think about the Backyardigans every time I say Nocilla Castaways. But let's get back to it. Hi, Allison and fellow Nocilla Castaways. This is Rod Simmons from Simple Mobile Review. This week, I'd like to tell you about a service called Award Wallet. But first, let's start with the problem to solve. I travel a lot, and I have a lot of different things I need to keep track of. So let me kind of give you a quick rundown of all the things I track in Award Wallet. This will kind of help you explain the problem. I fly American Airlines, Delta Airlines, JetBlue, Virgin Atlantic, U.S. Airways, United. I stay at Marriott, Hyatt, Hilton, Wyndham. I have an Amex, Banana Republic, Bank of America, Capital One, Chase, credit cards. I drive Thrifty rental cars, Avis rental cars, Enterprise rental cars, National rental cards, Hertz rental cards. I have gift cards from Amazon, Bass Pro Shop, Buy.com, Macy's, Toys R Us. I got to keep track of all of that stuff. And that's just a fraction of the things that Award Wallet can track for you. So you have a lot of frequent flyer points, let's say at various airlines, and you want to use those points annually to buy free flights. What you don't want to happen to those points is for them to expire. The challenge is, if you listened to all of those sites I listed, do you actually want to go to all of these various places to actually try to keep track of all of this stuff? Absolutely not. And that's what Award Wallet does. It allows you to go into a single pane of glass, Award Wallet, enter in the credentials for logging into all these various locations, and then it brings it all back down to a single place where you can look into. You can also have Award Wallet alert you to say, hey, just so you know, the points that you have on American Airlines are going to expire on this particular date. You can actually see that in the single pane of glass when you come in there, but you can also have the system alert you. It can also tell you about increases or decreases in points, alert you of those type of changes to the system. So while I said it can actually track frequent flyer programs from airlines, or, you know, you can do hotel stays, it can do rental car stuff, it can also do gift cards. So if someone gives you a gift card, rather than having to kind of keep up with that, you can just enter the gift card information into Award Wallet and manage it from within there, single pane of glass. So why the heck am I telling you guys about this? Like, why do you really care? What's the twist or spin? They have an app. So if you're rocking an Android phone, or if you have an iPhone or an iOS device, I should say, you can actually have Award Wallet on that device, and you can keep up as to what's going on. Now, as it relates to those gift cards, one of my favorite parts, and as well as your frequent flyer programs, you can tap on any one of your programs. You can see all your information, like, you know, from your login ID that you have, your frequent flyer number program, you know, the points that you have, your status, like how many points you are away from getting a different status on the particular airline or segments you might be away from qualifying. But most important, you can have it check to find out some additional information, or scroll down to the bottom and say, show my account number. So the next time you got a hotel checking in and they say, we don't have your number on profile, could you tell us what your number is? You can just say, show number, and it'll actually show the number right on the screen, but also it'll give you a barcode for some accounts where they can actually just scan the barcode to get your information in. Award Wallet for me is like a lifesaver, because I do a lot of travel and I try to use all the points that we gather, whether it be on a credit card or whether it be just from staying at a hotel, for free vacations in the summer and in the winters. So if you want to take all of those points you've been gathering up or accumulating throughout the various services and actually have an easier way to manage those, but most importantly, track and make sure not a single point expires that you don't get to use, I would consider using the Award Wallet service. I would also definitely consider downloading the mobile app because it just puts all of your Award Wallet information, all of the stuff you put on the website, right in the palm of your hand. Now, I know that this is probably only going to be interesting to probably some of the older crowd that actually travels for work or travels for personal, but it is an absolutely valuable application. It's been reviewed by the New York Times and the LA Times. They've done write-ups on it. It's a pretty reputable service. I wouldn't turn you on to something that I thought wasn't very reputable. So it's really good. They're tracking like billions of miles for, you know, lots of customers, and they handle up to 400 plus loyalty programs. So give it a shot. Tell me what you think. You guys have a good week, and I will be back next week with another free pick.
Well, thank you so much, Rod. This is really fantastic. Award Wallet really could come in handy for us. Just today, I was booking a hotel room, and I had to go fetch Steve to find his Starwood hotel number. It'd be really cool to have all that built in. I got to ask one question, though. When you were listing all of the places that you had reward cards for, did you actually say you had a reward card for the Bass Pro Shop? Really? Did I understand that correctly? If you get enough points, you get free worms? Well, in any case, I thought the listeners should get to enjoy just a little bit of the Backyardigans song, Castaways. I had never heard of them before, but this is a song, unfortunately, you may never forget.
Castaways, we are castaways. Ahoy there, ahoy, we are castaways. We're stuck where we are, with no house, no car. Castaways, ahoy, we are castaways.
Wow, that's just great, Rod. We will all hear that song in our heads every time we say Nocilla Castaways. Thanks a lot for that, Rod. Well, let's clean our palates from that with a word from our sponsor, the lovely folks over at Blue Mango Learning, makers of ScreenSteps and the new Clarify software for Mac and PC. Clarify is a tool that lets you write quick instructions to someone, complete with screenshots, with annotations, and also allows you to throw in some text if you feel that's necessary. But you don't have to. In a few quick steps, you've got an email ready to go that'll point them exactly where you need them to go. You can even make a link, send it up to the web. They give you a place to store it, and you can just send the link if you don't want to send all the messages, all the the images and everything in the email. I got to tell you, the outpouring of excitement and enthusiasm over Clarify has been amazing. A lot of Nocilla Castaways have checked it out. I've been getting letters from people all over the world who've already owned ScreenSteps and then added Clarify to their arsenal of tools. And I've also seen people who never saw the need for ScreenSteps, but Clarify just fits perfectly into their needs. Laura Schindler wrote in that she was excited because she could get a cross-platform version of Clarify to run on Windows at work and then use Clarify at home on her Mac. I hope you'll take a look at the free trial versions of both Clarify and ScreenSteps and find the tool or tools that actually fit your needs. Check them both out over at BlueMangoLearning.com. Well, it's time for yet another review from the famous George from Tulsa.
Three of us at two locations share 18 gigabytes of irreplaceable paper scanned to PDFs. There are hundreds of files. We keep a master and sync two other hard drives to it, both as backup and for active use. I'm reluctant to call it a system, though it does work. I think it would work better encrypted to the cloud with one shared data set. But first, it seems a good idea to verify that changes over the years are included in the master and not instead added only to a duplicate. I tried a visual comparison in Pathfinder and my eyes glazed over. Clearly, this is the kind of brainless, high-accuracy task for which computers were invented. Way back, I'm pretty sure I could have written a DOS batch command to do exactly what I wanted. Pushed to the wall and offered a last smoke, maybe I could use the Mac and some Unix commands to do my heavy lifting, but I'd rather not. Thus, my search for a GUI program to automate the comparison. Several possibles at Apple's Mac App Store, none with good reviews. Mac Update offered DiffMerge, cross-platform freeware from SourceGear.com. DiffMerge is one of several programming tools written by SourceGear. I needed only FolderDiff, the least sophisticated of DiffMerge's three functions. FolderDiff performs a side-by-side comparison of two folders, showing which files are only present in one folder or the other, as well as file pairs which are identical or different. Diff and Merge show changes among files and allow inline editing of content. Merge is said to safely and automatically check three files for differences and output a merged result. I think these functions could be invaluable to a coder. SourceGear includes a very good PDF manual within the DiffMerge download. I used DiffMerge on both Snow Leopard and Lion. You'll find links and a screen steps tutorial in the show notes.
Hey George, this is really, really cool. I very often wanted to run the diff command, and I know I also should remember how to do it in the command line, but I just don't remember how to do it anymore. Having it in a lovely free GUI is simply awesome, and cross-platform. I downloaded DiffMerge and made sure ClamX AV was scanning my downloads folder and opened it up. What a great tool. This will definitely come in handy. Did I mention to you how excited I was to get accepted to speak at Macworld 2012? Yeah, I guess I did mention that. Well, anyway, the folks from Macworld sent me a PDF to read, click little checkboxes, fill out some form sections, and then sign it. I thought I'd just whip open Preview, figure out a way to drag some slick-looking check marks from the Apple Character Viewer, and add my signature. What a nightmare that turned out to be. I found the check marks in the Character Viewer, but when I dragged them into Preview, they were huge. No matter how I tried to drag the corners of these tiny little graphics, well, that were too big, but were still small, they just wouldn't budge. I couldn't get them to resize, and I couldn't move them around to the right places. I fooled around this for like 10 minutes before I realized I was using the wrong tool for the job. I popped open PDF Pen from Smile instead, and when I dragged in the check marks, they were actually pretty close to the right size. I'm not sure why that was, but that was pretty handy. But in any case, I could still drag the corners to make them exactly the size I wanted them. I filled out the form using PDF Pen and then dragged in my signature file, resized it right there in PDF Pen, and then printed it all to PDF again. Not sure I had to do that last step, but it seemed to me that if I could make this all one graphic instead of them now having an easily extractable signature in my PDF, that would be a better way to go. PDF Pen saved me time, saved me grief, and allowed me to not procrastinate sending back my acceptance form. That's what I usually do when things get too hard. I just move on to something else. Check out PDF Pen and all the other great products from Smile over at smilesoftware.com. And be sure to tell them you heard about it here on the NoSillaCast. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for chit-chat across the pond with Bart Bouchatz. How are you this lovely fall day, Bart?
I am fine. I just had almost 2 hours worth of exercise, so I'm a little worn out, but I'm fine.
The good kind of worn out, though, right?
Yeah, I sort of feel, well, I was bold yesterday and had chocolate for the first time in months.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, so I figured, okay, I better do a good job on my exercise today.
So burn it off. So you went for a bike ride?
So I went for a bike ride. I had to avoid a lot of my usual trails because it's just been too wet here. Ah. I'd sink to my axles. But I discovered some new trails, so it's all good.
Oh, excellent, excellent. So you've been using that Track My Ride app?
Yeah, it's great.
That probably encourages you to try new routes, too.
Well, I guess it does, because otherwise you just look at the same map every time and say, oh, it's boring.
That's what I was thinking about, that Track My Run thing. I'd go, wow, that'd be really cool. It would show me go from here to here and back every Saturday on the Strand. So,
well, the other thing, of course, is doing the same route all the time gets a bit monotonous, whether or not you're tracking it.
Yeah, that's true. All right, well, we probably should check into the real work here. What's up on Security Light this week?
we have two real stories, and then we have two sort of little interesting tidbits I thought might be worth sharing just cause. So the first is that for Windows users of QuickTime, Apple have released QuickTime 7.7.1, which basically fixes all the security problems that all the relevant security problems that were fixed for Mac users in 10.7.2 or security update 2011-006 even.
Hmm.
So Windows users had another extra few weeks of vulnerability, but there we go. So they should update.
Now, is that the same as the one there was in, I think there was one for iTunes too, wasn't there? Or was that just because of the QuickTime component?
Well, iTunes also got updates that covered a bunch of stuff that on the Mac would not have been patched as part of iTunes, but would have been patched as part of OS X. Because okay, they kind of have to wrap more into the Windows versions of those two apps than they do on the Mac, because there is no OS X to piggyback off.
Oh, okay. Okay, so, but there was one for, I know
there was an iTunes one last time I was on, yes.
Oh, okay. I thought that it was just this last week. Oh, well.
Maybe it's possible. Maybe I'm misremembering. But yes, so.
Or maybe there's been two.
Or maybe there's been two. But basically, the Windows people get these fairly chunky updates because Apple have to sort of package parts of OS X into those apps to make them run on Windows.
Okay.
So the next one then is just a reminder, and yet another reason not to be. Ooh, I had to bite my lip so hard when writing these show notes. But don't steal software. And, you know, apart from the fact that it's not a nice thing to do, and so on and so forth, it's also really bloody dangerous. And this has been reinforced this week by some descriptions of some new malware that's doing the rounds on BitTorrent, embedded into, as the Mac Security blog described it, a popular graphics app, which they don't mention it by name, but I'm going to make a wild stab in the dark and say it's probably pirated Photoshop. But maybe it isn't. But that's my guess anyway. But this thing is, to be honest, it's quite sophisticated. So first thing it does is it looks to see if Little Snitch is installed. And if Little Snitch is installed, it doesn't activate itself. Because then Ooh. It would get caught.
Oh, how clever. So it's just like, okay, moving on?
Yeah, exactly. So it just says, oh, okay, not here, fine. And it deactivates itself. Therefore maintaining its stealth. Uh-huh. Then assuming it doesn't find Little Snitch, it does a couple of things. It starts by installing itself as a startup service on your Mac, so that should you reboot or something, it will still be there.
Restart itself, nice.
Yeah, because, I mean, you're running an installer when this thing installs itself, so you've just given it your password, so it may as well use that ability to install itself as a startup service. It also then creates a little backdoor for itself so that the attackers can come in at any time and issue commands to your computer. While it's at it, it has a little look around using Spotlight to see some certain file types it's interested in. It has a look to see if you have Bitcoin installed and steals all of your money if you do. Has a little look around to see if you have any interesting pornography.
What's interesting is it sounds like it's in the pirated application,
yes,
where people would have gone to BitTorrent, and people who go to BitTorrent tend to do these other interesting things. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like it's following the trail of what you'd be likely to do,
yes,
if you were doing those things.
Yeah, and then the other thing it does is it sets up a little service that listens for your keystrokes and logs all of your passwords and sends those back to the bad guys while it's at it as well. So it basically does everything.
Other than that.
Oh yeah, other than that, how was your day? Or how was the play, I believe. So it's a pretty advanced little bit of malware, and as I say, it sneaks in by sticking its installer script in front of the installer script for the app you're actually installing. So it gets installed, and then it goes on to install what you think you're installing.
Oh.
So as far as you're concerned, you type in your password, and what you wanted to install gets installed. So did all this other stuff. So it's Devil Robber is the name that Intego have given it. So I just thought it was worth mentioning, and really, sort of watching the Intego blog, more and more and more stories that are about new Mac malware coming out for the Mac, I really, really feel as if the quiet days are on the way out.
Behind us, huh?
I really think so.
I sort of feel justified and happy, though, when it happens to people who steal software. I know you were stepping lightly and being polite, but I'm
yes.
not going to be. It's like, ha ha!
Yeah, pretty much. I think a phrase I invented for a few years back was cyber Darwinism. So you just go out there and wipe yourself out of the cyber gene pool. That's fine by me.
Exactly.
Do the rest of us the world of good.
Now, that's all until something accidentally gets into something real.
Which, of course, it will. I mean, malware is malware. So the fact that it's easiest to get malware onto a Mac in a Trojan now means that that's what people are doing. Because they always, bad guys take the path of least resistance. They're not interested in doing something hard. They're interested in making money quickly and easily. Mm-hmm. So when Mac users, so for the next year or two, the chances are the weakest point on a Mac is the organic bit. And they're going to keep going after users through Trojans. But as Mac users begin to cop onto these things and begin to run anti-malware software, they're going to have to start being a little bit clever. And then they're going to have to start doing the more Windows-like things where you're actually exploiting software and sneaking in through web pages and all these kind of things. So expect to see it develop into a more Windows-like experience, unfortunately. But for now, there's sort of loads of low-hanging fruit. So those of us who are a bit more security savvy are not the target yet.
Okay, good.
But we will be. It's just a matter of time. Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay. So two little FYIs I thought I'd mention. The first is that Google are making some changes to how their search works. In particular, if you're logged into a Google account and you go to search Google, you will now find, or I'm not sure what date this kicks in, but it is coming, if not now, then soon, that when you go to just google.com, you'll find yourself redirected to HTTPS. Which means that the actual search terms that you type into the search box will be encrypted as they go between you and Google, and the actual search results will be encrypted as they come from Google back to you. So people spying on you...
Why?
Yes. Well, so that people can't spy on you as easily.
Okay.
I mean, Google have been rolling this out. I mean, Gmail went all SSL a while ago, and now they're bringing it out to search. And it makes sense, because Google are starting to customize their searches a lot.
Sure. I thought I was just really, really important because I kept seeing my own stuff come up in my Google searches.
It does give one a false sense of one's importance.
It was, and then I thought it was really interesting how often the thing I was searching for would show a tweet from somebody I knew. Like, wow. You know, it's
I know
really
the best
amazing.
People.
Exactly. I am connected.
Yes. Unfortunately, it's just Google being very smart. And to be honest, I don't like it one bit.
You don't?
No.
You don't like the customization. You like the HTTPS thing.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. The security is great. But this idea that there is no one search result anymore, that we are all living in a little Google bubble where Google hides from us. So if Google thinks we won't be interested in. So if we search for news, we're only going to see news that agrees with our political views. That's not healthy.
Hmm.
You really do need to see an unbiased view of the world unless we're all going to balkanize ourselves into partisans. So I don't like it. But there we go. So log out of Google and that problem goes away.
So this is a good change then?
Yes, the SSL is a good change. Absolutely. Because if you're sitting in net cafes and stuff, having people snoop in on your Google traffic is not a good idea. It'll help them fingerprint you and decide how best to attack you and stuff. So I think it's good. Keep that safe. It will have some side effects in educational institutions where it's not as easy to watch what the kids are up to anymore. But they have a solution for that too. You'd need to change your DNS to point google.com to the old insecure version of Google, and then you will be able to see what your students are up to. Okay. Anyway, so that's the first thing. The other thing is also Google-related. People have noticed, I think it flew by on Twitter, I think I've heard it mentioned on some other podcasts, that iOS has made a nice little change that if you watch very carefully while you're syncing your iPhone, you will see that it now says that it's syncing safe browsing data. And what this actually is it's syncing over to your iPhone a list of known malicious sites that Google maintains. And
then
So if you try to browse to one of those known malicious sites on your iPhone, you will get a warning to say, do you know this is a dodgy place? And then you can avoid it for yourself. So it's a simple little thing. Google have the list, so why not have it on our iPhones?
That's really interesting. I had no idea they were doing that.
Yeah. Yeah, if you watch very carefully, it's one of the sync steps. You might notice that it now says 1 of 7 instead of 1 of 6.
Yeah, I have seen 1 of 7.
And one of the really quick steps that flicks by in a second, because it's just a list of websites, so it really doesn't take up much data, is you'll see it's called it Safari Safe Browsing Data or something like that, but it is actually a list that comes from Google.
Okay.
So anyway, so I just thought I'd mention those two little things.
It's kind of neato.
Yeah.
Makes you feel nice, warm, and fuzzy.
Well, it's a sign that Apple are thinking in the right way.
Right.
Which is good.
All right, are we done with Security Light?
That is our vegetables eaten.
That was a good one. All right, what's our topic for the week?
So we all know that I've been off ill for a while, and I'm now sort of on the coming back to work. I've been back at work part-time. I'm now getting close to coming back to work full-time. And I've just realized that I'm spending way too much of my not that plentiful energy and effort just sort of managing things instead of actually doing things. And I figured that now is a good time to do a little bit of a spring clean, as I call it. But you told me I couldn't call it that because I'm not in New Zealand. So Alistair can spring clean. I have to autumn clean. I think you said it was fall cleaning, but I'm European.
Autumn. So it sounds so much more sophisticated.
Actually, here's one, right? We have the word autumnal. What's the American equivalent of autumnal? Fall. Well,
we have we have like the autumnal equinox.
Okay.
That'd be the only place I've ever heard it used. What's
autumnal? So you wouldn't describe weather as being autumnal, a scene as being autumnal?
No.
Okay. Oh, well, I guess you don't miss the word.
We'd say words like crisp.
No, crisp comes after autumnal. Crisp is into the winter months.
Well, we don't have those out here. So.
Yeah, you don't have that whole season. You skip that one. Anyway, so I have just... It's been something I've been doing. It's not something I did this week. It's something I've been doing for the last few, about 6 or 8 weeks, really. I've just been sort of rethinking things, going back to the drawing board and saying, okay, so I've ended up doing things this way simply through pure evolution. You know, a little Band-Aid tacked onto a Band-Aid tacked onto some sellotape, and it just organically evolved into this mess. If I was doing it from scratch, would I do it like this? And the answer was regularly no. Mm. So why don't I clean the slate and start over and clean up a lot of things and make things as simple as possible? And the difference has been wonderful. It's been so liberating. I have so much more time to actually get things done and so many less distractions. So I really quite like how it's worked out. So I thought maybe I would share. It's not a very focused discussion. It's quite wide ranging. So I broke it into topics that I tackled. So the first thing I tackled was my password manager, because I wasn't particularly... I had been using one and it was working, and I've used it for years, and I think I remember describing the user interface as if it had been vomited out when I described it on this segment. And I kept on hoping that as new versions came out, it would improve. And yeah, new versions came out, and yeah, new features were added, but they were tacked on in horrible ways, and it just wasn't... I didn't feel like it was in this century anymore. So I said, no, it's really, you know, been there, done that, time for change. And I looked at LastPass, and I really want a nice app. And I really want, you know, I didn't like this idea of it being tied to the browser, because for me, the browser is a tiny part of where I need passwords. So I didn't like that sort of old browser approach.
Okay.
So I hummed and hawed about it for a while and decided to give 1Password a go.
All right.
And I gave 1Password a go in an unusual way, because I didn't install a single browser plugin.
Oh.
I am just using the 1Password app.
And there's an app for OS X and an app for iOS, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So I got it from the App Store. As soon as I came into the App Store, I went, okay, that's what I was waiting for. Because I decided to buy it about 6 months ago, but I knew it was coming to the App Store, and I said, I'm not going to buy it as another standalone app that isn't going to be updated, blah, blah, blah. So I decided to wait until it came to the App Store, and then as soon as it did, I went and jumped on it, and I actually manually moved over my passwords, which allowed me to do 3 things, the first of which was just get rid of the glop. There's stuff in there from, you know, ISPs I haven't been with in 4 years and all this kind of junk. So
My closet cleaning theory, right? Take everything out and only put back what you need. Don't sit there. Don't ever do the migration assistant.
Exactly, yes. And I think you do have to do that from time to time with everything. And the other thing I did was I reorganized things much better, because the old password manager just had basically the equivalent of folders. So everything was in one place, and often things didn't really make sense in one or the other. And I just ended up putting everything in MISC, which is not good. Whereas with 1Password, it has my favorite thing in the world, which is tags. So I was able to tag everything, which meant that some things had 3, 4, 5 tags, which is fine. And then I could set up smart folders to suck out what I wanted. So I was able to very quickly get out all the relevant passwords for different sort of frames of mind, different uses. And the 1Password could be in 2 places, depending on what keywords I gave it. So that allowed me to get things a lot more streamlined, so I could find my stuff a lot quicker.
So is that because when you're going to search for it, you don't remember the name of what it is?
I often forget that. And the fact that you have different categories of things makes that easier, because different things have different icons in 1Password. Mm. And that in itself is a big help. Hmm. Just the fact that server passwords look like a little server.
Oh, cool.
And email passwords look like a little envelope. And so for keys, have a different icon. And so even that, combine then with the keywords where you can really narrow things down and have your safe searches. So I like it. It allows me to organize well, so I was happy with that. And it syncs over Dropbox, so I can get it on my iPhone and my iPad, and so I like it. I also took the opportunity to weed out my weak passwords.
Yeah, that was a big thing for me when I finally went to LastPass from using another tool, was I was able to just look it right in the eye and go, okay, that's not good. Fix that.
Yeah, this one has to go and this one has to go, which is also why XKPassWD got written when it did. Because I had passwords on my mind, and then the idea came up, so it ended up happening. So that, I guess that explains the timing on that a little as well. And I'm really quite happy with how that's all worked out, and I don't miss the old tool one bit. There's a couple of things in 1Password I change. I'm in the middle of writing up a review, so I have an Evernote that's building up with sort of the good, the bad, and the indifferent. So probably within the next few weeks, we might do a more detailed look at 1Password. But for now, I think it's just enough to say that the reorganization was really good to do. Then the next thing I tackled was email.
Wait. One thing I did want to tell you is you really should put XKPassWD on your homepage, on your content, so we can get to it quickly.
I probably should stick a little icon to it somewhere, shouldn't I?
Yeah.
Yeah, I should. I might talk to it. Stu did the artwork for me. I might talk to Stu by just doing up a tiny little banner I could stick in the sidebar.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a good idea. Thanks. I will do that.
Because I did go there looking for it, and then I had to sit there trying to remember what it was, what the name of it was, and it would be easier if I could start at bartb.ie.
If you go to bartb.ie/xkpasswd, there's actually a HTTP redirect that will do that.
Right, but I'd have to remember that it's called XKPASSWD.
Yeah, which I think may be the problem with that name. It's a nerdy, cool name, but I'm not entirely sure it's good. Right. Anyway.
All right, so what's next? So your passwords are all cleaned up.
Yeah, the next thing I tackled was email, which is by far the most work. I started off by moving my domains. I had my own domains hosted with my hosting provider, and the service was, I mean, it was over IMAP, so in some ways it was fine. But in other ways, their webmail client was a bit poor, and their spam filtering was a lot poor. So I said, no, I could pay for service, or I could just transfer my domain's mail processing over to Google.
Mm-hmm.
And just let Gmail be my mail client, and I'll get some calendars while I'm at it. So I spent a bit of time doing that whole DNS thingy and moving all of the domains of mine on which I do email over to Gmail. So I now have a bunch of Google Apps accounts for my various domains.
Oh, okay.
Which allows me to have calendars and stuff, and it's nice. So bigger mailboxes, the better spam filtering. I was a little disappointed at first because the spam filtering was really quite rubbish until I spent a day teaching it. Hmm. And it seemed to be quite a quick learner because it cottoned on very quickly that all that astronomy junk from, for some reason, Californian Psychics Live felt I really needed to know about them and the First Church of Jesus Christ. But anyway, so they at first Google went, oh, he must want this. And then obviously Google learned quite quickly that actually he's not interested in either of those things.
So that's a good question. I run mine through Google as well, my podfade.com address, and I get virtually no spam. But I don't remember ever teaching it, but if I did need to teach it, I'd need to go to the web interface to do it, right? Not do it through my mail client.
Yeah, so for the first 3 days, I had the web interface open in the browser, but I was using my client as the main interface, and I was only using the web interface to keep the spam folder open and to mark anything in the inbox that should have been spam and anything that went into the spam box that shouldn't have been, just to correct its assumptions. And I found that after 3 days, I've never had to make another correction.
So you have to invest a little time to get started, but then once you do, you're in good shape.
Yeah, pretty much. And I did notice it differs depending on the kind of spam you get, because on one of my domains, it just learned instantly and I didn't have to do any work. And on the other domain, it got it 100% wrong. It literally inverted them. All of my real mail ended up marked as junk, and all of the things I didn't want ended up in my inbox.
No.
So, yeah, I just basically clicked on all those are junk, and then clicked on all the ones and those are not junk, and it learned quite quickly, so that worked out well. The other major thing I did was to sort of take stock of the, I think I had something like 20 email addresses. And sort of went, okay, time to pick and choose. There is going to be one email address for each aspect of my life and one email address only. All the others will be forwarded into those, but there will be 5 email addresses that are actually real email addresses and not forwards. So there is an address for personal stuff. There is an address for work stuff. There is an address for the web consulting I do sort of on the side sometimes, not really much anymore. And there's an address for podcasting. And then I use my iCloud address as my FaceTime and iMessage ID. That's it. That's all that exists. So all the rest funnel email into those 5 chosen addresses. And then I spent some time to set up those five addresses on all of my... Well, I didn't set them all up on all my machines. I sort of carefully chose. So the work address is not on my home iMac. Mm-hmm. It is on my iPhone, so that if I need to check something from work, I can without effort. But I don't want it annoying me when I'm not at work. So I didn't put it on my home machine. I did put it on my iPhone. And so
the one tricky bit with that, I used to do that, and I found more often than I would like to admit that I would send a work email to somebody's home address, and they'd get really mad at me.
Yeah, you do have to be a little careful which the from address is set from as you're clicking send on things, yes.
Well, but the two. So let's say you're sending an email to Patrick about work.
Okay, yeah. See, I tend not to run into that problem for the simple reason that we have a contact server at work, and that's I don't have my iCloud address book syncing into my work machine. The only address book...
No, but when you're on your iPhone. So you're on your iPhone, you've got both of both of his addresses.
To be honest, I would only ever use my iPhone to reply. So I will check to see if something has blown up.
Sometimes I would forward something to someone because I wanted them to take care of it because I wasn't there, of thing. And, it just happened over and over again. Finally, I said, okay, I can't have my work stuff on my iPhone. Just, I can't do it. Yeah. I screw this up too often.
Yeah, I tend to do it purely so that it's the difference really between... I work in a place that has flexi time, and it's the difference between... So you get up, you look at your phone, has the place exploded? No. I can hit snooze for half an hour. If the place has exploded, okay, I'm getting straight out of bed and I'm going right in there right now to fix things. So it's sort of to look in and make sure everything's okay more than to actually do work because we're not paid to...
Situational awareness.
It's situational awareness, exactly. And it's good to have it easy so you don't have to go and remember the webmail interface and all that kind of rubbish. So, but I did sort of pick and choose, but I was very careful when setting up all of these on all of my machines that they all point to the same folder for trash, the same folder for drafts, the same folder for spam, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Because I think it's very important that you don't end up... Because if you don't do that, you end up with five different... So one of them might use sent items, one of them might use sent mail, one of them might use sent, depending on your client's choices and preferences. And then you end up with these five places where sent email goes and these five places where drafts might be in these... You know, it's horrible when that happens. So I actually took the time on all of them to point all of my clients to use the Gmail defaults. So that I can use the Gmail interface and it will be right. And I can use mail that app and it will be right. And I can use my iPhone and my iPad and it will always be right.
So things from iCloud aren't going into the trash, say, for Gmail, right?
Well, they wouldn't be by default. But what I'm saying is I told all of my clients that the trash folder for this account is the trash folder that Gmail uses.
So they are all sending to the same one.
Yes, each to their own relevant one, yes.
So, each to their own relevant.
Yes. Okay, so within each account, the folders are set up correctly.
Okay.
So that all the clients agree on what is sent, what is trash, what is drafts, etc. And the Google Gmail interface also agrees with that, so they're all using Gmail's preferences.
Okay, great.
Which took a bit of jiggery-pokery, but it's done, and I'm happy with that. Then the other thing I did, which was tricky enough, was I said I finally had enough of Thunderbird. Years I have seen potential in that app, and every update I have been disappointed by the fact that it doesn't live up to it. It's lost potential, stuck in the past. Mail that app keeps moving on and getting cooler and cooler and cooler, and Thunderbird is just stagnated. So I said, I've had enough. And especially with Lion, I just said, no, that's it, right. The Mac now has it. Mail that app it is. So that I ended up, what I did in the end, because I had all iMap accounts, is I set up the new... So I did the change to Thunderbird at the same time as I moved my domains to Google. So Mail.app got the Google domains, and they were never added on Thunderbird. And then I logged into my old mail servers via POP in Mail.app. Oof. Oof. And then dragged and dropped the mail into the new IMAP ones.
Oh, you could just do that?
Yeah, you can drag and drop between any accounts.
Wow. Wait, from Thunderbird into Mail.app?
No. So I took those accounts that I was accessing from Thunderbird, and I accessed them from Mail.app over POP.
Oh, okay. So everything downloaded locally, and then you dragged them into the...
Exactly. And because it's POP, it just downloads once. It says, shroom, and then you have this glut of mail, and then I sorted it by sender, and I filtered out Amazon and all this other junk, and it just went straight in the bin. And then anyone I cared about got dropped into the appropriate...
That's the part I've got to do. For some reason, I'll get, some Amazon spam, whatever, and I'll read it, and then I won't delete it. It's like, I have all this crap.
Yes.
11,000 messages in my podfeet.com address, and I guarantee you that is an 11,000 good ones.
Yes, which is the next thing I did was to try tackle that, because this was what was causing me so much distraction. And it was actually it actually meant that important stuff was getting lost amidst the sea of notifications from Twitter and Flickr and G+ and Amazon and iTunes and...
Yeah, yeah. So why do I need something that says so-and-so added you on Google Plus? I don't ever need that.
I think you can turn that off. I kind of like just to see in case there's someone I know from college.
Oh, I like to see it, but why do I keep it?
Exactly.
Why don't I hit delete?
Exactly. So I now have, using the Gmail interface, I set up what everyone else on the planet would call folders, but what Google call labels. I set up a label called notifications, and I set up a sub-label inside that label for all of those services that generate a lot of email. And then I set up filters, and those filters are on the server side because they're done through the Gmail interface, which means those filters happen before any client is involved. So I don't have to have any machine on for the filtering to happen. It happens before I see the mails. And so no matter what client I use, I see the filtered mail. So now all of those services get filtered off into that subfolder of notifications. They never hit my inbox because I check the little checkbox when you're setting up a filter that says don't let them even hit my inbox. And so my inbox only contains stuff that isn't automatically filtered away. And then when
I have, with that is I never go look at those filtered folders.
Well, see, I do because you know, I say to myself, I wonder what's been happening on Twitter today. And I go to Twitter and then I do Twitter for 5 or 10 minutes. And then I go back to doing whatever else I was doing. And I'm,
so it's only those major automated kind of things. You wouldn't say filter everything from your boss.
No, no, I don't believe in doing that. No, it's just those automated services that I'm filtering.
I'll never forget at work one time, I came up with this really clever idea. I was getting a couple hundred emails a day at work at one point in my career, and I was just struggling with a way to deal with it. And I thought, okay, anything that I'm CC'd on, I don't need to really deal with that, right? Because they didn't think it was important enough that I was on the to field. So I'll take everything where I'm CC'd now, just shove it in a folder that maybe I'll check on. Guess what you're CC'd on?
Oh, well,
meeting notices.
Yeah, no, you're CC'd on all sorts of stuff, yeah.
All of my meeting notices were wrecked. I mean, it was I missed like 12 meetings in a row. I was like, what's the matter with you? Why aren't you showing up to things?
Yes, that's one to watch out for. So, but it allows you then, so I just choose, I'm now going to see what was going on Flickr all day. None of that Flickr stuff distracted me when I wasn't looking at it because my inbox never saw that stuff. None of the Google Plus stuff, none of the Twitter stuff. So I just choose. I just say, I wonder what was happening on Flickr. I wonder what was happening on Twitter. And I just take 5 or 10 minutes. I deal with it, and then I can get back to doing whatever I was doing. And some of them, I really don't care about. Like all of my receipts from iTunes, I want to keep them. I don't want to ever see them. So they get shoved straight into a filtered folder and marked as red.
So you do all this on the Gmail side.
Yes.
You don't do it in...
Don't do it on a client.
Why not?
Because if you do it on a client, then that one machine has to be turned on in order for the filtering to happen.
Oh, you know, this would solve a problem of mine. Is I've got, for example, right now I'm on the Blog World Expo Facebook group, and it's just spamaholic. It's just driving me out of my mind. So I created a smart mailbox to just drag it out and put it over there. And when I'm on my iPhone, it doesn't work.
Exactly.
They're all in my way.
Yes. By doing it in the cloud, no matter what device you use, iPhone, iPad, whatever, the filtering is done on the server side, so it just happens.
How clever you
are. As the mail comes in, it gets filtered before it even hits your inbox.
I like it.
I discovered the joys of this because our work mail system supports server-side filters. And once I realized that on my iPhone, my mail was filtered too, I was like, oh my God, this is what I want for everything. And when I realized that Gmail could do it, that was a big pull to pull me towards Gmail.
Yeah.
The other thing I should say that took a little bit of time was I went through all of those other things that generate mail and made sure that I changed the email address on them to be the one I wanted.
Oh, wow.
So I had to go into the group hug, as we call it, for the Mac Roundtable and point it at my podcasting email address because it used to be at my personal email address. And so I did a bit of jiggery-pokery. So now I have filters on each email account dealing with only the notifications that belong there, and there's no notifications going in the wrong place anymore.
Okay.
That took a bit of jiggery-pokery. Then the other thing I decided to do was to create a folder called Archive, which mail.app will let you do very easily because there's an Archive button that will make the folder automatically. And the inbox is only for things that I am actively working on that need my attention. The moment they don't need my attention anymore, they go into Archive. And because of how good searching is, there's no need to break it down into different stuff. It just all glops into Archive, and then I can get it by sender and subject and so on and so forth, and by conversation afterwards.
So I get, what is, what really is an archive folder? Is it archive?
It's just a folder called archive.
Okay, so it's just a conceptual thing. It's not a different kind of folder.
No, no, it's a regular old folder on an IMAP server that's called archive, because that's just where you put stuff that's not currently on your to-do, but you want to keep it.
Okay.
So either it'll either get deleted or archived, is how things go. So my inbox will only ever contain email that I need to act on. And I do not let it develop a scroll bar. The moment it develops a scroll bar, it's a sign that either I have not actually been archiving or I've been slacking off. And I should deal with whatever needs dealing with and not letting it pile up.
Wow.
But because all of the Flickr stuff isn't mixed in there, it's much easier to do that. Because none of those distractions get in the way. Because I used to sort of theoretically follow the same idea. And I'd work through stuff and I'd hit up something from Flickr that I said, I must deal with that later. And then I'd stop reading up through the email. And anything before that Flickr email that I might not deal with for 2 days, anything other than that got forgotten about. And then maybe I'd never get back to that point because so much other crap would have come into my inbox. And I actually ended up losing someone their domain name with that carry-on.
Oh, no.
Which was a bit of a sort of a red light that you need to get better at this part. So, yeah. So now, you know, the inbox is what I'm doing now and nothing else. And it's really pleasant, actually, to go over to the inbox at the end of the week in work and see that it's empty. So, yeah, that's it. I'm done.
I've never done that.
Usually there's one or two things. It's rare that it's actually completely empty.
I remember at work once I saw the bottom of my mailbox and I actually had less on the screen, fewer messages than would fill the screen, and I went, because I thought something was broken.
I mean, I have 4 in my personal inbox, I have 5 in my consulting inbox, I have 2 in my podcasting inbox, and I don't know how many I have in my work inbox because I can't see it from here.
How do you know how many you have in your inbox? Oh, because you can see
them. Okay, because on mail.app, I break my inbox. I click the little disclosure triangle next to my inboxes, so I see I don't see one inbox.
Right.
I see an inbox per account.
Okay, but you can tell there's 10 because you can count.
Because I can count to 5.
Okay, because
yeah.
I was going to say, I'm looking at my inbox, and I don't know, the scroll bar is about...
It says it actually at the top. 6 messages come with 1 unread.
Oh, okay, so where it says 17,840 messages, 5 unread?
That'd be the place, yeah.
Ah, okay.
Oh, dear.
What? You know what Kyle does? Kyle keeps everything in the trash.
Well, that's a bit weird.
Yeah, he reads it and then he throws it away. That's his sorting. So his mail is always empty.
I use the archive. It's a bit more for that. And the last thing just to mention is a lovely feature in Mail.app that I don't know people know about. It's called redirect. So you right-click on the email and you say redirect. And it's like a forward, only instead of being FW and all that crap, all it does is it changes the to address, leaving the from address the same, leaving the email untouched, and sends it back out onto the internet. And so it will just show up in the other email account as if it had been sent straight there.
Wait, what? Why? What's it called again?
So it's redirect.
Okay. So is this because you don't want it to go
there? Yeah. So let's say that someone sends you a podcast-related email to your personal address. Mm-hmm. You could reply to them and say, don't ever do that again. Or you could just go redirect and let it push itself into the right inbox that way.
Oh, but you automatically do it. I mean, you manually do it. You push a button that says redirect.
Yeah, push a button that says redirect because it doesn't happen very often.
Yeah. Okay. I thought it was automatically doing it.
No, so you right-click, you say redirect, and then it just shows up in the other inbox as if it had come straight there. It doesn't have the forward, and the sender isn't you and that kind of rubbish. The sender is still the sender, and the to address has all that's been changed. And so then once you hit reply, then the problem is gone because the person is going to hit reply to you again, and then the stream goes into the right mailbox. You don't have to worry about it anymore.
How odd. Okay.
Yeah, because very few people actually type email to you. They find an email from you, and they hit reply.
Right.
So once you get them corrected on an email thread, you know, that's it. They're done. It'll come to the right address from then on. So that's email. And that was a big deal. And that took a lot of time and effort, but I'm so glad it's done because now I spend so much less time worrying about my email and I get more done. And I don't lose things.
Cool.
I forget to do important things. So the other thing I consolidated, I call it my online presence, all these social networking thingamabobs. Something I also did is I updated some sites on my website. I was horrified to read my own about me page. It's like, that's an interesting, this is a very interesting person, nothing like me anymore.
And coincidentally, I was looking at it today.
You do. It was interesting because you sent me a typo, and I was literally getting ready to fire up Mars Edit at the time and go deal with it. But not to fix the typo, just to fix the fact that the information was way out of date.
Yeah, it's too bad I didn't notice it years ago, right? That would have been handy back then.
So it's been updated now, so it's more correct with reality. But the other thing I did was to sort of consolidate social networking a little, and I decided to only keep Twitter, Flickr, and Google+. And so basically the biggest victim there is LinkedIn. I don't care. All it did was generate spam email.
Yeah, I never haven't figured out what it's for. I think we have to be looking for a job to care.
Yep. Or be in sort of a consulting role where all jobs are temporary and you're just bouncing around from job to job to job. Yeah. Whereas those weird people like us who have, you know, permanent pensionable job, it's not for us.
How strange. Yeah.
Yeah. We're old fashioned, you know. But I just got rid of it. It's like, all you do is generate spam. Go away. And it made me feel very guilty about it. And all of these hundreds of people I'd connected with, and I was like, I don't care.
Oh, so you actually quit it?
I actually quit it. I went and I went close account, and it told me all the sob stories. And I went, I don't care, close it anyway. So off it went. I did that to Facebook a couple of years ago. I did LinkedIn as well. So now it's just a small set of distractions.
Actually, you did keep YouTube too.
Oh, sorry, I kept YouTube as well. So one for photo, one for video. Twitter, just because it's really good if you're a podcaster to be on Twitter. Mm-hmm. And G+, because that's the only social network I actually like.
Me too. So.
I really like it. So the other thing then is IM services. Mm. And I culled those, but the biggest victim there was ICQ.
Oh, you'd had that forever.
It was my first, yeah. I had my ICQ as my first ever internet chat account. And it was in the days when it was still considered okay to have a number instead of a username. The service had been buggy the last while, and it kept on disconnecting and reconnecting. It was just awful. So I messaged everyone on my address book who I didn't already have another account for. And I said, I'm sure you have something other than ICQ. Are you on GTalk or MSN? And they were all on one of those two. And so I just copied over those people and nuked the account. And so basically it's now just GTalk and MSN is all I bother with. And mobile me because, well, I have it, So I don't really use it, but I have it.
Yeah.
So it just actually felt really good to cut down on all that spam generating stuff. And the next thing to tackle was hardware. Because before I got ill, my main machine was my 17-inch MacBook Pro. And that was where everything was, and that's where I did everything. I also had a G5 iMac, which I used when I wanted a bigger screen, but I would just connect over the network to get at my data and stuff. The MacBook Pro was it. It was my machine. And it's getting on in years. The iMac, unfortunately, died first. Around about last Christmas, the iMac packed in the ghost. So I ended up picking up a 27-inch Core 2 Duo iMac on the refurb store. And because it was a year-old model on the refurb store, I was able to get it at a fantastically good deal. And then I stuck in 8 gigs of RAM from OWC for less than €100, including all the shipping and charges and stuff to get it into this country. So at that stage, it felt very silly to have this 5, almost 6-year-old and aging MacBook Pro with only 2 gigs of RAM because it can't physically hold any more as my main machine, and this shiny new 27-inch iMac with 12 gigs of RAM sitting there just connecting to the other one over the network.
Is that really all you were doing with it?
It was for a week. Okay. And then I started to slowly move data over. And then about a month ago, I said, no, there's just no point. I think it was when Lion came out, it was just the final nail in the thing, because Lion won't run on a Core Duo. It will only run on a Core 2 Duo. And newer, because a Core Duo is a 32-bit CPU, and the Core 2 Duo is the 64-bit one, and Lion is 64-bit only.
Right.
So at that stage, not only was the machine old with not really enough RAM, it couldn't even take the latest OS, and it did not take me long to fall in love with Lion. About 15 minutes. So the thoughts of having my main machine be in an old OS, I said, this is the end. And every bit of data was moved over. And so my iTunes library went, my Aperture library went, everything went off and onto the iMac. And I don't think the laptop's getting replaced.
Yeah. Now, what are you going to do with it?
I'm going to keep it around the house. I mean, it still works. So it's still good for looking at the flash video in the kitchen.
There you go.
But it's been reduced to my player for The Daily Show.
So it's a TV.
It's a TV for one. Yeah, really.
It's a nice TV.
It is, especially because you can carry it around. And it's handy to have a machine if I'm going to visit my parents for a long weekend or something. It's nice to be able to take a computer with me. Because as great as the iPad is, it's not quite, you know, your only computer for 4 days. No thanks. I'm a bit too much of a power user for that. I don't feel comfortable. So the laptop will hang around for that. And it might get replaced if, you know, things, this recession picks up. I might pick up an Air, maybe. But really, my focus is iMac plus iPad.
Yeah, yeah, don't really need
and to know. To that end, I've picked up a VGA adapter for the iPad and a copy of Keynote. And next month, I'm giving a presentation, and I am not bringing my laptop with me.
Wow. Now, be careful when you do that. There's boogery differences between.
I'm also bringing a copy of my presentation on a thumb drive, and I know there will be other laptops in the room. So if all goes terribly wrong, I will have a copy for a version of it converted to .ppt. And I can run on anyone's computer.
Another option is, actually, I don't know whether it'll export out from the iPad 1 or not to the projector, but would be to have a PDF version of it.
I always do that too, actually. I have a PPT, my actual .keynote file, a PDF file, and I usually export to HTML because everyone has a browser.
Right, but I'm thinking also on a PDF that you've mailed to yourself or put in Dropbox or something.
I usually use Dropbox.
Right, because I think you can. I'm not sure whether the PDF would export out from the iPad. That'd be a question.
I need to test that. So my VGA adapter is due to drop through my letterbox in the next 2 to 3 business days. Mm-hmm. So I will test and play. But yeah, I want to have a couple of options. But I know that if all else fails, I can actually use. In fact, I know that there's a computer in the room I'm giving the presentation, so I just plug the thumb drive into that computer, and then I can give my presentation.
Yeah, the iPad 2, you can project everything.
Yeah,
it's really
which is nice. Yeah, but you know, so I think that'll be an interesting little test. But I genuinely think it's come to the stage where iPad plus iMac is enough, and I think that might be why the desktop isn't on its last legs,
getting a bit dusty.
It's why I think that the desktop actually has quite a bright future, because I don't think I'm going to be the only person who realizes that this is a nice way to work. Because a 27-inch screen versus a laptop screen is quite a difference.
Yeah, yeah.
So I think the iPad may stunt laptop sales. I don't think it's going to kill desktops. Anyway, we'll see how it develops. And we're almost done. The other thing that got revamped, thanks to Lion mainly, is sort of my outlook on backup and security and stuff. So because I've all gone all Lion on all machines that are actually used for anything, all of my disks are now encrypted. Internal disks, external disks, backup disks, the whole lot, all encrypted. Which makes me feel a lot safer.
Nice.
So if someone robs something, they don't have my data.
Inside, outside,
whole lot. Exactly. Wherever they are, they're all encrypted. And that's I like that a lot. The other thing then, because I had this problem where I just had these hard drives sprouting everywhere, and I was buying bare hard drive and an external case, and I was sticking it into the case because it was cheaper that way.
You should get a Drobo, Bart.
I would love a Drobo, but I don't have the money.
Don't have $1,000 sitting around?
Precisely. So what I did do is I bought a little dock from Freecom that will hold IDE or SATA drives.
Oh, I love those things.
Yeah. So now, all of my disks that I actually use as disks, as information stores rather than as backups, are in my many caddies many external cases that I had. And all of my backup drives are not in cases anymore. They're bare drives, just in little anti-static bags. And they just get dropped into the dock when I need to do a backup. I now have... I bought a new 2 terabyte drive to free up 2 500 gig drives. Mm-hmm. So I have 2 identical 500 gig drives that I use for my offsite backup.
Oh, nice.
And at no point, so they're always circulating. So there's always one of my quote-unquote offsite backups offsite, and there's always one at home. And then when I want to swap the disks, I bring the one from home to where my offsite stuff is, and then I bring the offsite stuff home. So not even for 1 minute
are they ever
is all
in the
of
same
my
place
together. Yeah, so sometimes there's 2 copies offsite, and sometimes there's 1 copy offsite, but they're never all 3 copies together. And I like that a lot. Because I cycle, and if it's raining, I can sometimes end up not being able to complete a transaction because I'll cycle in and I will have a hard drive with me, and then it will rain when it's time to go home, and I'm not cycling home with my backup.
Oh, good.
In the rain, because that would really make it not healthy. So by having it this way, it's okay if for 2 or 3 days, depending on how bad the Irish weather is, 2 of my disks are on my offsite site.
Right.
Because it's not, you know, my data's still at home. I still have a Time Machine backup as well. So there's 4 copies of everything. So, you know.
And I'm starting to think backups are getting into a competitive field now here is where I talk to people. I tell them that I have three. They go, oh, you only have three backups. Oh, okay. Yeah, so you're not really serious about it then.
And what I've actually done, because I've switched to using Carbon Copy Cloner for most of my backups.
Huh.
Because it's just easy. Make this disk be this disk.
Uh-huh.
It's very easy. But I can't do that on my internal disk because my off-site backups are 500 gig hard drives and my internal hard drive is a terabyte.
Right.
So what I actually have, I'm still using my old rsync app to selectively, to exclude my temp folder, my downloads folder, my podcasts folder, which then gets my backup down to 500 gigs.
So Carbon Copy Cloner can only do everything?
Yes. Okay. It can do other things, but it's not as good. It's not what it's good at.
Okay.
It's really good at cloning a disk. It's less good at... It can clone a folder, but it can't clone a list of six folders.
Oh. Okay.
So I have a little preset in rsync that takes my iMovie stuff, takes my iPhoto stuff, takes my Aperture stuff,
sure.
takes my music library, takes my documents folder. Just this list of stuff and copies that onto the external disk. What I've actually done with my two identical external disks is I've given them the same name. So whichever one I plug in, it mounts to the exact same point in the file system, oh. So the exact same backup script will work because it doesn't realize it's a different hardware.
Oh, that's an interesting idea because that is a problem I have with SuperDuper is I go to work and it'll go, I can't find the backup drive. And you go, well, use the one I just plugged in, moron.
Yeah, so I just give them exactly the same name. And because I have one dock, I can't possibly physically put two disks into one dock. So I can't ever get it wrong and have both of them connected, which would probably cause my Mac to go very confused. So they just have the identical name, and I just plug whichever one in I want and then do my backup, and it's all fine.
Okay. So,
and I'm happy with that, and it's actually saved space on my desk because the only hard drives on my desk now are ones with actual information on them, which is what I want, and my Time Machine, because I just want that plugged in. That's the point of Time Machine. So the last thing then, I'm sure I've run horribly over time here.
We're at 48 minutes.
Yeah, okay, that's it, yeah. Okay. Last thing, though.
Do it.
So I have a bunch of domains, and I've always used a registrar that it was an Irish company, and I used them for the simple reason that, you know, there's a campaign here, Buy Irish, sort of support the Irish economy, and I thought, you know, they're no different in price to the GoDaddies of the world, so why don't I use an Irish company?
Mm-hmm.
And then they were taken over by a British company. So now I don't feel the same level of loyalty. And like almost everyone on the planet, they charge you extra for domain privacy, which
right.
means that if you do a who is on a domain registered with someone who doesn't do domain privacy, your name, your address, your telephone number, and your email address are listed on the who is data, which is a wonderful spam generator.
There you go. Hey, by the way, hover.com... I think it comes with it.
Well, it's funny because the next bullet point was, so what I've started doing is moving my domains to Hover.
Nice.
Yeah, because so I wasn't particularly loyal to the service, and they were looking for, I can't remember the exact price, but it was more than the price of the domain for a year to get domain privacy for a year.
Yeah, it
so
is
I'm not
a
paying
lot.
More than double. Jesus, you know? And I have, between my own domains and domains I have that I hold on behalf of customers, I have about 100 domain names.
Wow.
And I'm the technical contact on them all. I'm not the owner of them all, but I'm the technical contact on them all. So that's my email address, my phone number, on all of those domains. Apart from the .ie ones, which has domain privacy at the actual domain, not the who sells you the domain level, but the actual people who run the IE domain level. Because Ireland is a closed domain, so only you have to go through the Irish Domain Registry to get a .ie domain. And they give you free domain privacy, but apart from your name. So your name and then a serial number is all people see. And then the only people you know what that serial number means is the IE Dior.
Right, right.
It's the only thing they got right. I hate just about everything about the .ie system, but that bit I like. So my .ie domains are going to have to say where they are, and that's fine, because none of them have my email address or my phone number on them. But all my other domains, as they expire, because I can't afford to move 100 domains in one go, because that would cost a fortune. So as they expire, or as they need renewal, I'm moving them over to Hover. And it's so nice. It's a pretty interface. It's full of Ajax. It's simple. It's quick. I had a really bad first experience because they had some sort of funny server issue where I was getting all these evil timeouts. And I thought, oh, my God, what have I done? And since then, it's been fine. Thank goodness.
Oh, good, good, good. So did you also do that very much as a... spring clean or an autumnal cleaning method there where you only moved over the stuff you really needed?
Yeah, I've let a lot of my domains lapse. I had sort of, as new domains were coming out, I think .au came out, and I thought, ooh, I can own BartB.au. Okay, that's $20, €20 a year, and I'm using it for nothing. And then I had BartBouchas.net, and I had a whole bunch of these, and I went, no, I'm just keeping the actual ones I use. So yeah, there's a lot of domains have just been let expire.
Yeah, so did you end up saving a lot of money?
Yep. Yeah.
Excellent.
It was kind of surprising how many of these junk domains. And I would, like with XKPassWD, when I have an idea, unlike with XKPassWD, most of my ideas don't actually make it to the finish stages because I have an idea and then I get distracted. Ooh, squirrel. And that's the last that ever happens, that idea. So I have all these domains for ideas and I just let all them go.
Okay.
You know, I've had a year to do this and I haven't done it. I'm not going to do it. Let the domain go. And I think I let about 10 domains go, which $10 a pop a year.
Jeez.
That's $100.
$100. $100 towards MacBook Air. And again, you would not have succeeded at that if you'd gone through your domains and tried to turn them off. Mm. Right? You had to leave them behind, right?
Yes. Yeah, just, you know, just ignore. Yeah, the domain renewal. Yeah, whatever.
Yeah. All right. Wow. You really did do some spring cleaning or autumnal cleaning.
I feel much better for it.
All right. Well, we are now at 52 minutes. This might be the longest chit-chat of all time, but I enjoyed every single minute of it. And I've written down a whole bunch of notes of stuff to ask you when we get off the air.
Uh-oh.
No. All like, ooh, that's cool. Now I want to ask you more questions, but I knew this was going to go long, so I didn't.
There's going to be a while till I get to make my pumpkin soup.
Oh, I'm sorry.
It's fine.
All right. Well, we'll talk to you again soon.
We will indeed. So until then, happy computing.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Many thanks to our sponsors for helping to pay the bills. We have Blue Mango Learning at bluemangolearning.com with Screen Steps and Clarify. And don't forget all the great products from Smile over at smilesoftware.com. And another thing not to forget, send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions by emailing me at allison@podfeet.com. Follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/podfeet. And I contribute a lot over on Google+, so just search for me by name over there if you want to circle me up. If you want to join in the fun of the live show, and I highly recommend it, head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic NoSilla Castaways, complete with their own theme song. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.